gangbusters. Just great. When people ask us how we're doing, we often say fine, even if it's not always the case. If you aren't fine, say something. To get help, call InfoSocial 811. Because talking is the first step towards getting better. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Welcome to the Thursday, February 17th edition of Drama Text. And tonight on the show we have two presentations by Anne Carson, one at the Hammer Museum in Los Angeles and another at the British Library. So they last about an hour, and here they are, Anne Carson.
I'm Stephen Yancer from UCLA's English department, which along with the museum is largely responsible for this event, which is the first in the Hammer poetry series this year. The series began on campus in a lounge at the Sunset Canyon Recreation Center many years ago. It's now almost 50 years old. And for 25 of those years, it was overseen lock, stock, and scanted barrel by Doris Curran, who, given her skimpy budget, often fed the poets. She's a wonderful cook, and lodged them in her home, and probably, if the truth be known, she probably clothed some of them too. And the series is dedicated to her in memory. Our budget is still a cause for concern, but our sponsorship is not nearly as rickety as it once was. The Office of Cultural and Recreational Affairs at UCLA has been with us from the beginning, and we're especially grateful to the Friends of English, a terrific support group for the Department of English that helps to fund these events. In the old days, these weren't complicated affairs to stage. We had only to get the poet to the podium, mostly sober. Now they can be complex enough that it's not clear that some of them should be called poetry readings, case in point. Fortunately, the Hammer staff and technicians who are in the charges of Claudia Bester, who's the most resourceful and patient head of public programming on the planet Earth, always rise to the occasion. Anne Carson's previous extravagant, polymorphous, and polygraphic productions, often classified by default as poetry, include, along with poems lyrical and otherwise, translations from ancient Greek, dramatic monologues, fiction, treatments for scripts, scholarship, and philosophical explorations, among many other things. Her books, usually mixed genre, include Knox, an elegy, at the same time that it is a dismantling of a famous elegy by Catullus, is in the form of an art book, housing accordion pages of poetry, quotations, collages, and photographs. And The Beauty of the Husband, another book subtitled A Fictional Essay in 29 Tangos, is written in verse. These are just Decreation I wanted to mention. Decreation is it's nominally an opera libretto, one part of which has been accompanied by an installation of visual art. And these are just a few of the bewildering array of border-crossing objects that Anne Carson has committed. When I asked her in an email how we should characterize or title her event here, she said, "Oh, just make something up." So I took it as a whimsical challenge, but then I couldn't think of anything that might not be a stretch for her. She has already done it all. In due time, she wrote again to say that she had decided to provide a lecture on the history of skywriting at the Hammer. Well, I was fascinated. I hadn't even known that the Hammer had ever had anything to do with skywriting. Although it turned out that she meant that while at the Hammer, she would give or perhaps perform a lecture on skywriting, the other possibility seemed entirely plausible to me. And now, willy-nilly, we will indeed be able to witness the beginning of the history of skywriting at the Hammer. So I'm going to abandon this stage to Ann Carson and her friends, Jessica and Avon, and Bob Curry. I don't know what to tell you to expect. It's a brand new piece. As you can see from my little prologue, the past can't be any kind of preface to what we're going to get today. So you're on your own.
Lecture on the History of Skywriting. This is a lecture on skywriting. My own. I am the sky. Here follows a brief history of my life as a writer. Preface. At first I wrote only for myself, nothing else existed. In the uncounted millennia before the Big Bang, when I was a riot of atmospheres and inexplicable non-gravitational intensities, before the creation of galaxies or cherry trees or rational thought, before the creation of creation, I kept a few notes. I can't call it a diary because day as such did not yet exist, but it had the same solipsistic purpose, to prevent the moments of my own life from being allowed to waste away like a tap left running. As Virginia Woolf put it on page 239 of volume 1 of her somewhat later contribution to the same genre. Of course, taps as such did not yet exist either, but I'm trying to give an impression of a tendency to self-reproach that I shared with Mrs. Woolf from the beginning. We writers feel the burden of being a subject in process, no matter who we are. Footnote 1. Linear time, a human and mortal invention, makes no sense to me, it goes without saying, insofar as I have always existed and probably will. But I recognize that humans find a temporal framework helpful in grasping larger ideas. So let's pretend that the eras of my development as a writer succeeded one another as days of the week, on a sort of biblical model, with the modification that on the seventh day, rather than resting, I came here. Monday. On Monday, I had innumerable girlfriends and a few boyfriends and wrote up lists of these with capsule biographies and ratings on a scale of 1 to 10. Also a fair number of sonnets. The universe was expanding, redshift by redshift. Most of my paramours were chunks of frozen rock, miniature suns, minor moons, dwarf planets. I struggled with a few passionate asteroids, but in general avoided asteroids as being too small to get hold of. I was a super hot, super dense young sky, and I liked a good bit of rebound, especially against the cosmic microwave background of that first day, so to speak, of my autobiographical week. It was a rubbery time, nothing nailed down, emotions oscillating like crazy. Every desire broke me open in a dawn of Tiepolo pink. Yet I have to say I was never more physically fit. Due to the level of G-force pressure experienced during cosmogonic workouts, I could chart hourly improvements in bone density, lymphatic drainage, and overall mood. Sex was my angel of reality on Monday, better than bowling or daily aspirin. I did not worry about being exhausted by Tuesday. But then, late Monday night, a certain Alcmene broke my heart and I had to pause. Alcmene was a nymph of Argos with light brown hair. She was unusually tall. I'm speaking metaphorically, there were no nymphs or light brown hair or tall or short at the time. There was hydrogen, there was helium, there were nuclei interreacting in an atmosphere of persistent radio noise at a temperature slightly above absolute zero, minus 273 degrees Celsius. But a nymph makes a good story, and given the pace of activity on Monday, I had to fall back on narrative cliché. So, during that era of my unbridled panspermia and serial fireball fusions, I was coupling with nymphs and engendering heavy elements all over the universe. I kept a list, as I said, and Alcmene was number 1,408. I saw no reason why my 1,408th nuclear interreaction should be any different than the previous 1,407, but there you go, the heart has its reasons, which reason knoweth not, as someone said once. It was Pascal. I liked Alcmene much too much. She liked me not at all. Technically, she was already married, had stopped expanding her galaxies, but I was undaunted. She told me she found me an inelegant solution to a non-essential problem. And in fact, the night I had my way with her, she went immediately down the hall and slept with her husband. The result of this three-angled sex act was Heracles, a creature in whom matter decoupled from light. Born with a twofold nature, half mortal and half immortal, not a single incandescent clarity existing everywhere at once without regret like me, Heracles was a thing of ordinary substance, a thing with specific life and limits in space and time. In other words, he had to die. Christopher Hitchens once said to me that having a child is like your own heart walking around in another body. So there went my own heart walking towards its own death, every millennium, every hour closer. I could not bear this. I decided to make a deal with the laws of physics. Or maybe it was the laws of metaphysics, I get them confused. Anyway, we all agreed that if Heracles were to set himself on fire and burn to death, his finite human nature could be purged away in the flames and leave the infinite part, the part like me. I thought this a clever solution. Unfortunately, I overlooked the essence of death as an event. It happens in time. For a mortal creature, death is instantaneous. You're alive 1 minute, you're dead the next. But for a creature who exists, like myself, outside time, death has no instant. I have no instant. I am at all times. I have to watch my most beloved child burn to death at all times. And I always will. Monday is the day I learn not to make deals with the man. Tuesday, I became clouds. Possibly a defensive measure. Everyone loves clouds. They lift the heart, they lift the eye. Actually, they lift the heart because they lift the eye. Cognitive scientists say that people place gods in the high blue sky because looking up causes a rush of dopamine in the brain. Yet clouds do more than draw your eye upwards. They invent your imagination. This happens on a small scale when you lie on your back on a hill on a summer day, gazing up and saying, "Oh, look, that one's a camel. There's Werner Herzog, a can opener, the Taj Mahal." The interpretation and reinterpretation of shifting shapes of cloud is one of the most basic exercises in free imagining known to you dwellers upon the earth. Also useful for reminding you that most of the ideas you conceive about the world are fragmentary, fugitive, self-ruining, and soon forgotten. However, when I talk, within the framework of my autobiography as a writer, about inventing the imagination, I mean something else. For a while, during the so-called Enlightenment era, when human beings in general, especially highbrow middle-class Europeans, were so gripped by rationalism and so besotted with notions of intellectual control that natural lectures offered on topics from hydraulics, magnetics, and mathematics to volcanoes and the operations of the human heart were attended by hundreds of people, during that, as I say, tender-minded era, I made myself available to analysis. I gave them to believe that I, the clouds, could be reduced to a typology. It was hard work. I had to replace the shapeless caprice of my atmospheres with four basic cloud types. I had to edit the indecipherably fluid filigree of my language into a dry-as-dust classificatory system replete with Latin terminology. And beyond that, I had to be flirtatious. If you bring a concept or category up close enough to the human mind to be very, very attractive, and then whisk it away so it stays out of reach, it becomes erotic. Flirting is not in my nature, but who would be bothered doing science if it weren't erotic? The four basic cloud types, as defined by amateur nephologist Mr. Luke Howard in a lecture at Plough Court in London on 10th December 1802, are cirrus, cumulus, stratus, and nimbus. Cirrus, from the Latin for lock of hair, means a tendril or fibrous shape. Cumulus, from the Latin for heap or pile, means a heap or pile. Stratus, from the Latin layer, means a horizontal band, and nimbus, Latin cloud, is a rainy combination of the three previous types. It was, let me repeat, hard work to dash around the universe impersonating these four cloud formations, not to mention the ceaseless transitions between them with their seductive lacy gaps, and to keep this up day and night for years until Mr. Luke Howard gathered enough data for his taxonomy. It was an athletic time for me. I had to practice a lot, and the tricky thing about practicing if you're the sky is there's nowhere to go to be alone. You are already everywhere. I won't burden you with the solution I found for this. It involves string theory, and we haven't got to that day of the week yet. Mr. Luke Howard's taxonomy of clouds was just one small component of the scientization of all things that began with Descartes and has shaped the mess in which the present world finds itself. Still, I am perversely proud to have been a part of it, insofar as my contribution was a work of fiction and ought to have subverted the whole taxonomic process. And I admit I was surprised when reason prevailed, from which I learned never to be surprised when reason prevails, especially if its data are imaginary. At the same time, the experience refreshed and refocused my own creative process. Let me quote here John Cage. Something has to be done to get us free of our memories and choices. Wednesday. Exhausted with hauling myself around the upper air in cloud masquerade, I decided on Wednesday to sit at my desk, use the telephone, and do an interview. I interviewed pebbles and small rocks. Insofar as I have, so to speak, all the time in the world, I could interview all the pebbles and small rocks in the world simultaneously. Even so, it was a quiet experience. The questions were formulated as a sort of quiz. Here's a précis of the most interesting answers that the pebbles and small rocks gave to my questions. 1. Smoothness. 2. The Krumbine Phi scale of sedimentology. 3. Mars. 4. Golf on Mars. 5. Put up signs expressing state of mind, for example, "Yes, I love you, help." My questions had been concerned with the following areas, respectively. 1. Criteria for racial or class prejudice in your community. 2. A better way to judge the National Book Awards. 3. Favorite vacation spot. 4. Favorite vacation activity. And 5. What you would do first if you had hands. Well, the pebbles and small rocks interview didn't even take all morning, so after lunch, I picked up the phone again and called that gentleman everyone was waiting for in the latter part of the 20th century. Here is a transcription of our chat. First things first, do I call you Godot or Godot?
Why not use my first name?
Okay, what's that?
Rusty.
So, tell me, Rusty, how did it all get started, the non-arriving?
Started in a thinness.
What sort of thinness?
Thinness like the plate you climb back up over from behind when waking from a very flat dream.
Any narrative trajectory?
Keep moving at all times. Avoid touching the hole at the center of the thinness.
What's the hole for?
Discourage snooping.
Any music?
That sort of honky-tonk thing, mostly percussion. I didn't like it. I didn't do the music.
What about lighting?
Floodlights.
Oh, Rusty, how exhausting.
Yes, exhausting, not to say boring. I would have been monumentally bored had I not met Yoko Ono, who gave me a few suggestions for passing the time.
Like, for example?
Like, for example, send a note of appreciation to silent, courageous people you bump into. Metal workers, mothers, street sweepers, etc. Keep doing it. See what happens.
Well, that might be a good note to end on. Faintly redemptive.
Oh, but listen, I have quite a few more anecdotes left.
You know, Rusty, it's been a hard morning for me.
How so, Mr. Sky?
I've been trying to get a few sound bites out of the pebbles and small rocks.
Pebbles and small rocks, say no more.
You know them.
Mr. B auditioned a whole bunch of pebbles and small rocks before he hired me.
Well, one can see why.
Sure, good looks, natural talent, but no method, no sense of elsewhere. Pebbles and small rocks just don't know how to bring it up from inside.
Did you enjoy working with him?
Oh, God, no, what a monster. If we asked him questions about the text, he'd warn us to be on guard against committing reason.
Sounds like John Cage.
Much harsher man than Cage. Build a little kingdom, then shit on it, he would say.
I am familiar with that impulse.
Well, time for my afternoon nap. Goodbye, Mr. Sky.
Thank you, Rusty. It's been a consoling hour. Thursday. Maybe because Wednesday had been a good day, almost Proustian, I made the mistake on Thursday of attempting to write a memoir of childhood and all but vanished into its vortex of prehistoric pain. There were mountains piled on mountains, mothers frustrated, fathers castrated, brothers and sisters driven down to hell, the usual family horror and disputes about who gets to use the car. I won't bore you. I drew a big X through the manuscript, deleted it from the computer, and sent a note to Yoko Ono. Footnote 2. Memoir writing was for me a process that entailed long periods of silent reflection. during which I tried to keep my mind motionless and my eyes downcast. Here is my favorite thing to look at with eyes downcast. Forest shade, lake shade, poplar shade, highway shade, backyard shade, cafe shade, down behind the high school shade, cow shade, carport shade, blowing shade, dappled shade, shade darkened by rain above, shade under ships, shade along banks of snow, shade beneath the one tree in a bright place, shade by the ice cream truck, shade in the new car salesroom, shade in the halls of the palace just as the electric lights turn on, shade in a stairwell, shade in tea barrels, shade in books, shade of clouds running over a distant landscape, shade on bales in the barn, shade in the pantry, shade in the ice house, the smell of shade, shade under runner blades, shade along branches, shade at night, a difficult research, shade on rungs of a ladder, shade on pats of butter sculpted to look like scallop shells, shade to holler from, shade in the chill of bamboo, shade at the core of an apple, confessional shade, shade of hair salons, shade in a joke, shade in the town hall, shade descending from legendary ancient hills, shade under the jaws of a dog with a bird in its mouth trotting along to the master's voice, shade at the back of the choir, shade in pleats, shade clinging to arrows in the quiver, shade in scars. Footnote 3. Meditating on shade led me to wonder and ponder absent presence in general, and to begin to worry about those many sky-related questions which will undoubtedly remain unanswered in your mind when this lecture is done. For example, 1. Is the sky blue? 2. Is the sky round? 3. Is it proper to use the informal second-person singular pronoun tu or toi when addressing the sky? 4. Do hawks and falcons look so fantastic rising and falling because they have the sky as background, or would they look equally good flying through mud or a piece of corduroy? 5. Ontologically speaking, is the sky something, or merely what is left over because everything else has edges? 6. Can the sky break? 6a, if it broke, could it be built again? 6b, if built again, would it change its ways? 7. Is there one sky or many? 7a, if many, do they know about each other? 8. Are there some outcast skies? 9. Is it true the question mark derives from the shape of the tail of a cat when surprised? Sorry, unfair question. Here's another. If a scholar of the Rig Veda went to a Chinese restaurant, what would his fortune cookie say? Answer, congratulations, you love Chinese food. Footnote 4. Now that we are so well embarked on footnotes, which have their own sort of sluggish energy, here's 4 minutes of deleted material from Wednesday's interview with Rusty. Rusty, what does your father do?
Cows.
How many cows?
5, 6.
Did you help with the cows?
Every day, down to the river we went.
What were those days like?
Long.
What did you do?
Talk to them.
Talk to the cows?
No, mostly the plants. I studied all the plants, tasted all the plants, talked to all the plants and introduced them to one another.
Why talk to the plants, not to the cows?
Plants know how to listen. Cows don't. Cows are crazy, especially ours. Ours never got enough to eat. People think cows are fat and peaceful, but those are government cows. The government buses those cows ahead to anywhere there's going to be a photo op. Those are the cows that show up on TV, living the good life. But ours were scrawny and terrible, ran all over the place.
Still, those cow herding days must have been good training for you, for the non-arriving.
I guess.
Seems to me that although waiting is hard, especially waiting for something never arrives, never arriving is hard too and has just about as much waiting in it.
Well, I've got a talent for it.
Me too, actually. Being the sky involves a fair amount of just hanging there.
Oh, it's very different.
Different how?
Well, one thing, I have to keep out of sight. But then also, and this is a factor very few people appreciate about my work, non-arriving isn't one big simple thing. It's different every time. Every case unique. It's tricky, layered psychological work. Analogies like web and maze come to mind. A long, painful, undirected intimacy between strangers with no common goal. Ideally, I make a slow appeal to feelings unexpressed and end by drawing tears from a stone.
Sounds like the secret police.
There's a pissload of research going into all this.
But here's a question I've been curious about for years.
Let's have it.
Why do you never arrive? I know it's your job, your assignment, your role in the play, but tell me the truth. Isn't there something deeper going on?
Like what?
Like bearing witness to the atrocities of our time?
Nope.
Really?
Never gave a fart for atrocities.
You're not calling history to account? You're not using silence to speak louder than words? And put us all in the rearview mirror of our mere and ending world?
Oh.
And we should draw no apocalyptic conclusions whatsoever from your steely reticence.
You know what? Every October, I rake apocalyptic conclusions into a pile in the backyard and burn them.
Do you?
But I suspect we've lost track of your original question.
Which was, why don't you arrive?
Why don't I arrive?
Yes.
Okay. I'll give you an answer, but you won't like it. You'll say, we can't end there.
Shoot.
Who told me this was my Uncle Roy? I liked Uncle Roy. A little short man full of fantastic alibis. He worked for the State Department a long time, then made a fortune by inventing the You Are Here map for public places. You know, the big map they have in parks and metro stops. And the thing about the You Are Here map is, by the time it's been up a year and a half, the U is entirely rubbed off.
No kidding.
So says Uncle Roy.
They rub it right off.
Because everybody wants to touch the U when they're lost.
Ah.
Has to be painted back on.
I suppose it would.
One guy's entire job all day to go around repainting second-person pronouns on You Are Here maps.
What about the red dot?
Well, the fact is, the red dot doesn't usually disappear, just the U.
Haunting.
No, it's a different kind of paint.
Oh.
So let me do a question now.
Okay, do a question.
How do you think the interview went?
Our interview.
Yes, you're the expert, I'm just an amateur. And I like to know how other people go about their craft.
Well, to be honest, Rusty, I was a little disappointed in my own performance. In the sense that whenever I listen to interviews on the radio, they get in at least once and usually several times the question, and how did that make you feel? But with you, I didn't find any place to work it in.
Tell you what, I'll ask you that question.
Just out of the blue?
No, I'll give you a context. Here, let's say it's dusk in America, you're not the sky anymore. You're some traveling salesman driving along the freeway, and you pass one of those suburban, what do you call it, housing developments with a lot of little houses all the same, and a big billboard that says, if you lived here, you'd already be home. How does that make you feel?
Wow, Rusty, what a great question.
Take your time.
I have to think about that one.
Take your time.
It makes me sad then happy, happy then sad. And here I'll quote Proust, who was, with that weird devious moral power of his, able to capture in words so perfectly this quintessential experience of all the creeping creatures that creep upon the earth. And so it was from the Guermont way that I learned to distinguish those states of mind that follow one another in me during certain periods, and that even go so far as to divide up each day among them, one returning to drive away the other, with the punctuality of a fever, contiguous, but so exterior to one another, so lacking in means of communication among them, that I can no longer understand, no longer even picture to myself in the one what I desired or feared or accomplished in the other. That was from Swan's Way, translated by Lydia Davis.
I like it.
Me too. End of footnote 4. Friday. On Friday, I decided to delegate. Why do all this thankless work writing if I can hire a ghost? So for a while, I experimented with skywriters, skytypers, and sky dot matrix printers. There are aeronautical experts who perform all these media in little airplanes that exude picturesque white smoke. I have to say, I was disappointed in the level of invention overall. I had envisioned epic poems in hexameter verse arcing across the heavens from Patagonia to Paris. I got instead, "I love you, Doris," and ads for Lucky Strike. Capitalism got its hooks into this art form from its first breath in 1922. But halfway through Friday, I realized I was on the wrong track. I was looking to the public for what could only be private. I had to step back from the marketplace to the inside of the mind. That's when I became a Hindu, or at least very deeply interested in what Hindu scholars of the Rig Veda mean by writing. The hymns of the Rig Veda contain the following suggestion: something only exists if consciousness perceives it as existing, and if a consciousness perceives it, within this consciousness, there must be another consciousness perceiving the consciousness that perceives, and so forth. You can pursue this regress in an inward direction, as Vedic scholars do, or you can go the other way and find sky upon sky upon sky, perceiving all the degrees of consciousness in the cosmos. You need to take a breath to think this. And your breath is the thinking. We think each other back and forth, your mind and me. We write one another. Put this a different way. Consciousness and sky, or mind and cosmos, are organically related. They mirror and enact one another. The Vedic scholars whose care was to transmit the thousands of hymns and ritual directives and meditations that comprised the Rig Veda did so for 3 million years by oral tradition, without writing down a single word, because they saw the texts inscribed inside their minds. Of course, they had to pay attention, and for the most part, they were fantastically scrupulous, both in reading these inward texts and in performing the rituals prescribed by them. But a wonderful and forgiving aspect of Hindu thought, to me at least, is the notion they had that if someone did make a mistake in a ritual, a witness who noticed the error and who knew the correct text could mend the mistake on the sky of his mind and so make the cosmos perfect again, microphysically. I spent the rest of Friday noticing various acts of mending going on throughout the cosmos here and there. I felt calm and hopeful. Then about 12 o'clock my mood changed. I'm not sure why. It was midnight, but darker. Saturday. Asimana. I am the sky. Thank you. Saturday, I awoke conflicted, for I realized, autobiographically speaking, that there remained one vast area of self-experience unexplored and unexplained, namely, sky as a medium of annihilation. Warfare is a fact of life for all the creeping creatures that creep upon the earth, as the book of Genesis calls them on the sixth day. And warfare is mostly a history of death-bringing stuff flying through the air. Bombs, bullets, bows and arrows, Big Berthas, B-52s, poison darts, poison gas, portable nukes, cannonballs, curses, lethal drones. My first instinct was to fashion all this into a fast-paced crime novel. Certainly there were crimes. But it proved impossible to condense that long evil doing into a simple algebra of cause and effect. Crime fiction is very condensed, and its impact on the reader derives from giving a face to the algebraic components, the victim, the criminal, the detective, the good, the bad. Warfare has grown increasingly faceless throughout its history. Surely Hector and Achilles looked into each other's eyes on the battlefield. But in 1092, Pope Urban II found it necessary to outlaw the crossbow as being inglorious due to its distance from death. And by the 21st century, a soldier in Nevada can push a button and have five people in Pakistan burst into flame. Without the face, no ethics. This is an old idea. But also without the face, no function for me, nothing to write about. No one can make sentences using only verbs. No one can tell a story without believing in the reality of other people. Yet I don't expect all you creeping creatures that creep upon the earth to stop wanting warfare anytime soon. And I don't expect me to stop delivering the hysterical valentines of your desire through my beautiful blue air. That's who we are. Saturday was the day to acknowledge this. Every writer's week arrives at a Saturday, a day when he wishes it were Monday again and he could start over with the innocence of his first sonnets. Or even the relative rectitude of Tuesday, when the Enlightenment was dawning, and Immanuel Kant was writing sentences like, Two things move me to wonder, the starry sky above me and the moral law within me. Those starry skies don't come back. So now it is Sunday. Creation rests. I close my notes. Like every author, when I come to the end of a piece of writing, it is quite clear to me that I will never write again. The upper air, the middle air, the lower air is blank. Blankness plunges out of it. Blankness plunges out of it and goes elsewhere. And I suppose it will arrive. The end. Good day. Never read sitting down before. It's strange. I'm used to being more commanding. This is a novel about a red monster with wings named G. Besides being a red monster with wings, he's a fairly nice person and has various adventures. He makes his living as a herdsman. He has a herd of musk oxen, which he keeps in a meadow somewhere outside New York City, I think, although it's obscure to me exactly where it is. And you'll also meet in this section his best friend, whose name is Sad But Great, usually known as Sad, who is a veteran of some war or other. This takes place at night. Typical night herding songs gallop their rhythms and tell of love. G does not usually sing to the herd at night. He may talk to them, listen, stand in the herd, listen. That community, a low purple listening, but with a height to the sound, them listening. They direct it up and out. They stand in a circle facing away from the center. And the long guard hairs hang down to brush their ankles like pines, like queens dressed in pines. Musk oxen are not, in fact, oxen, not castrated bulls, nor do their glands produce musk. Much is misnomer in our present way of grasping the world. But pines do always seem queenly, as they sway so grand and anciently from the sky to the ground. Motion is part of listening. As the night goes on, let's say he's there for a number of hours, the motion changes. At first they just shudder a bit, like any large entity come to rest, but gradually, imperially, they begin swaying. Then as one rhythm they pass the sway from shape to shape around the circle, its amplitude increasing, its warmth rising from knees to hearts to eyes, its pressures rolling across the large loose joints of the shoulders and down the large bones of the hips, until at some point, with a phrasing as simple as a perfect aphorism, one of them spins up off its shanks and performs a 360-degree spin in air and returns to place, slotting itself into the undulation of the others as firmly as temptation into I can resist anything but. He slips from thought to thought. Wild, wild, wildness does surely attract him, although what he knows about wildness is not much. He knows with the oxen that they prefer common gorse to willow shoots and can balance the top heaviness of their bodies by plating their feet as they walk. While with sad, he knows, don't mention war play. Funny word, war play. Never says war or warfare. I've seen a lot of war play, he'd say. War play had me pumped those years. Tip of the spear, flip switch inside. She hit the ground, 75, saw the white bag, 75 bullets tore her head off. I saw her hand. I wasn't going to tell anyone back home about, oh, it found its way out, it surfaced. I had a tan when I came home, no wounds, no cuts. Everyone kissed me. Sure, I sat by the fire, I talked to the old man. There were the smells, the bone beneath. Sweat broke out on me at breakfast. I didn't expect to come home, that wasn't in the plan. Some point, I guess, the brain cells just give out. You read 100 military manuals, you won't find the word kill. They trick you into killing. You get used to it, it's okay. You have to. Fear not tolerated. Take you out back and shoot you, they say. Her eyeglasses in the grass. Standard questionnaire, fine, just say fine. Numb yourself. Wireframe eyeglasses. Does it feel good at first? Yes. Play, guns, fire, animals. You know, the Carthaginians like to use oxen for night fighting. I'm talking about Hannibal. I'm talking about the Battle of Ager-Falernes, 217 BC. Oxen are like tanks, but more frightening. They'd tie lit torches to the horns and stampede them toward the enemy. The Romans panicked. Some ran into the herd. Some got knocked off the path to the crags below. Others tried to retreat and were lost in the tundra, never seen again. But what about, I'm asking, what happens when the torches burn down? To the horn, to the hair, to the head, to the bone beneath. So much human cruelty is simply incidental, is simply brainless. Simply no common sense. You could take the entirety of the common sense of humans and put it in the palm of your hand and still have room for your dick. This is a novel that has a Greek chorus. She is called Wife of Brain. I'd like to read two sections of the chorus. This one is pertaining to Sad But Great, the war veteran, Wife of Brain. Hits the floor if a truck backfires, can't stand the smell of diesel or rain in May. You ever see their orders were to mow the children? No one let a pig in the shape of a down pig bleed. Would he ever let a pig bleed to spare it at such evening your nightfall bleed? Drugs in, they come with the death in a padded bleed. He said, sweet mead, I have to let the pain, the blades, the steeds, the brittle children. Carving Vicodin, methadone, Paxil, let a big X drank out a nightfall across his belly, let cut sweet out, let the pain out. As will happen in a novel, time passes, and there is a chapter about time here. Time passes, time does not pass, time all but passes, time usually passes, time passing and gazing. Time has no gaze. Time has perseverance. Time has hunger. Time in a natural way. Time when you were six, the day a mountain. Mountain time. Time I don't remember. Time for a dog in an alley caught in the beam of your flashlight. Time not a video. Time as paper folded to look like a mountain. Time smeared under the eyes of the miners as they rattle down into the mine. Time if you are bankrupt. Time if you are Prometheus. Time, if you are all the little tubes on the roots of a gorse plant sucking greenish-black moistures up into new scribbled continents. Time it takes for the postal clerk to apply her lipstick at the back of the post office before the supervisor returns. Time it takes for a cow to tip over. Time in jail. Time as overcoats in a closet. Time for a herd of turkeys skidding and surprised on ice. All the time that has soaked into the walls here. Time between the little clicks. Time compared to the wild, fantastic silence of the stars. Time for the man at the bus stop, standing on one leg to tie his shoe. Time taking night by the hand and trotting off down the road. Time passes, oh boy. Time got the jump on me, yes, she did. At the end of the novel, the hero, G, is called home to his mother's bedside. She seems to be dying. He's visiting her in the hospital. He brings lilacs from the bush by the corner of her house, to which she will probably not return this time, or ever, and he leans his face into them. The smell plunges up, a vertical smell, wet, purple, unvanquished. Her door is shut, the ceiling tracks flicker. No radios, no barbecues, don't honk, a sign he saw on the way to the hospital, his mind running like a dog off its chain. Certain things not decided have been decided. He arrived on the day after her surgery, has seen this corridor at all hours. Notices again a hesitancy in the light, as if it were trying not to shock you with how scant it is. He can hear the oxygen machine through the door. It shunts on, runs a while, shunts off. He enters. When he is there, they lift the stones together. The stones are her lungs. Same hospital another day. Not a casual solitude, he and she. Oxygen machine is wheeled in and hooked up. Her eyelids flutter, but do not open. He sits. The room is hot. There is a smell. Does Proust have a verb for this? This struggle she faces now, her one-time terrible date with night. First date, last date, soulmate. Old song lyrics scamper in him. He moves the chair back to the window. She's counting. My soulmate gasps of, make my heart beat at a fast rate, oxygen. He dozes off. Waking to her avid gaze, wide open. She holds in one hand a makeup mirror, in the other a pair of tweezers. Here, she whispers, lifts tweezers. Maybe you can do it, taps the end of her chin. He hesitates, shrugs, pulls up his chair, takes the mirror and peers close. A beard of very tiny white translucent hairs all over her chin. He moves the oxygen tube aside and gingerly plucks a few more. There are hundreds, thousands. He hates waiting for her to wince. She doesn't wince. It's all right, Ma, you can hardly see them, he says. Her eyes fall. Okay, never mind. Sadly, she takes the tweezers back. I look awful, don't I? No, you look like my Ma. Now she winces. In later years, this is the one memory he wishes would go away and not come back. And the reason he cannot bear her dying is not the loss of her, which is the future, but that dying puts the two of them now into this nakedness together that is unforgivable. They do not forgive it. He turns away. This roaring air in his arms. She is released. Final chorus. Mothers in summer, mothers in winter, mothers in autumn, mothers in spring. Mothers at altitude, mothers in solitude, mothers as platitude, mothers in spring. Mothers banking their shots, mothers grackling their throats, mothers dump from their boats in spring. Mothers as ice, or when they are...
En présence de symptômes de la COVID-19, comme la toux, la fièvre, le mal de gorge, la perte du goût ou de l'odorat, isolez-vous et faites un test rapide à la maison. Pour en savoir plus et connaître les consignes d'isolement à respecter pour vous et ceux qui vivent avec vous selon votre résultat de test rapide, consultez québec.ca/isolement. On continue de se protéger. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
Oui, c'est chaud pour le Monstone! Chaud pour le Monstone! Oui, c'est chaud pour le Monstone! Chaud pour le Monstone! Chaud pour le Monstone! Chaud pour le Monstone! Oui, c'est chaud pour le Monstone! Chaud pour le Monstone! Oui, c'est chaud pour le Monstone! Chaud pour le Monstone! Chaud pour le Monstone! Chaud pour le Monstone! Et oui, mesdames, mesdemoiselles, messieurs, ce moment que vous attendiez tous, taquez bien votre chapeau de forme sur votre tête avec un gonne à clous, c'est chaud pour le Monstone! Chaud pour le Monstone!